Welcome to the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Elliot Berlin. Today, we're talking about child safety, including the importance of learning CPR and first aid, and how to make your nest a safe environment for young children. My guest today is the owner and founder of Save a Little Life. It's a small but thriving health education company started back in 1999. He and his staff provide specialized courses for expectant and recently delivered parents, family members, and care providers, as well as courses for families with toddlers and older children. He has 40 years' experience as a registered nurse, working in acute care at large medical centers. He's been an advanced and basic life support instructor with the American Heart Association since 1989. Richard Pass, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Elliot. Happy to be here.
First of all, do you have any idea how many people you've taught CPR or first aid?
I did the math recently.
You did?
It's going to be pretty vague, but I think the numbers are well into the 15 to 20,000 range.
That's incredible. We've touched. Wow.
Yeah, it's stunning when I think about it.
It's fantastic. Let's go back a little bit. How did you get started in this career, and then what led to starting Save a Little Life?
Sure. Well, you know, when I first thought about becoming a registered nurse, it was kind of an odd selection for a lot of folks, and even for myself.
Odd in what way?
Well, at the time, one out of 20 registered nurses were men, and so okay. We were an oddity.
I know how you feel because I'm a doula.
There you go.
I think you are a very small group on Facebook.
Very much so. So once I realized that it isn't so much the gender as it is the person and how they care for people, that pretty much went away. But still, I'd get that occasional, "You're a nurse, right?" "Yeah." "You're a male nurse, right?" I said, "Yep, that's correct on both counts." So I worked mostly in acute care, and I was I'd done some work in CPR, some CPR training. Back in the day, it was very complex, especially the advanced life support stuff. But we learned how to sort of make it work for us in the hospitals, and if there's a need in those situations, we respond quickly and as a team. I had been working at Cedars for quite a while and had. Some friends asked me about what do I do if my baby or small child is choking, or if they, are pulled out of the water. What do we do? Because really, this had not been taught in any great extent to the public. There are courses, and there are some organizations that are probably well known that teach it, but the lay population, I don't believe, was very well served by the way in which we taught this stuff. Mm-hmm. Tended to be focused a little bit more on technical issues and using some medical terms and some other things, and I think also the way that we approach this is a home related event most likely. This is something that happens at home. It doesn't happen in a hospital. And people who respond are people who probably don't know very much about this. So I tapped into this sort of unexpectedly to a population of parents, expectant and recently delivered, who wanted this service, who really wanted it. So it started trickling in the very early 90s. And then with a little bit of advertising and a little promotion, we hooked up with a couple of other companies and things took off. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect it to be as popular as it was. I wound up quitting that job and letting it go and doing this pretty much full time. In addition to some other teaching activities.
Who would have thought that was going to happen?
Yeah, I really didn't think it was going to be something that would sustain itself. And next year, we're going to be 20. So that's pretty remarkable in itself.
Yeah, it's a big accomplishment. And are your classes mostly local? Do you do them all here? Or now that online is possible, have you gone that route as well?
Yeah, our courses are this is a brick and mortar kind of a thing. We either go to locations where parents already shop or do certain kinds of activities related to their infant or small child, or we come to the home. Mm-hmm. We make it easy for them. We bring all our materials, and these are courses that are conducted in a pretty simple manner, but they do cover the essence of what we're trying to get across. And that, of course, is the emphasis first and foremost on prevention, making sure that parents understand the truth about where babies and small children tend to perish. Most people don't talk about this very much. Where do babies die? Where do children die? And of what causes, what reasons?
You mean injury-related?
In many cases. Not so much from the standpoint of an illness, but more so an accident or some sort of an injury. These are accidental deaths, sure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Centers for Disease Control keep these statistics. They're pretty well available. So what we've done is we've created, at least in the beginning of our program, probably half an hour or so, maybe a little longer, of an accident prevention checklist and a whole series of things that if parents pay attention to, they can really reduce risk greatly for any kind of untoward event.
Are these things, when you say accident prevention checklist, are these things that within the home that when you're preparing for a baby to come or if you've just had a baby that you do? Is this like baby-proofing kind of stuff?
Or? No, we're not baby-proofers in that sense. Yeah, baby-proofers come in and identify risk in the home in very specific ways.
Like this is a pointy corner on your table.
Corner.
This outlet means a little pluggy thing.
That's right. And there's a steep staircase there, and there's an unstable cabinet over there that probably needs to be adhered to the wall.
And then I came home one day, and my wife had put a lock on the toilet. There was a toilet lock, and I remember it was such a good lock, I couldn't figure out how to use it, which left me in quite a predicament.
I've had a couple of close calls in people's homes, some really good quality.
Toilet
locks. Kids are probably better at getting these done than I would
exactly.
be.
I had to go ask my kid, hey, how do you open this thing?
Really. Baby proofers serve a very important function, and one of the things we do is we have a resource list for parents. We give them a number of different companies who do this sort of thing. We don't focus on just one, so we have that available. But the accident prevention checklist that I refer to is really, have you attended to those things that are most likely to take the lives of your little ones? So these come from pretty hard data between, for example, birth and year one. The focus tends to be more on SIDS prevention and some suffocation-related issues.
SIDS being sudden infant death syndrome.
That's correct, sudden infant death syndrome. And I should just remind the audience, if they don't know, that within the last year or so, maybe a little longer, the anti-SIDS scientists and researchers have come up with a revised set of guidelines. And what's different about this set of guidelines is that it includes a slight kind of an offshoot of the primary SIDS diagnosis. And of course, we know that a SIDS diagnosis is generally a baby that is put down for a nap or for a prolonged sleep and just doesn't wake up. The confounding thing, of course, for everyone is that on autopsy, many of these babies do not have any pathology or any reason for this to have happened. Mm-hmm. I think in some cases, parents would almost prefer to have a reason.
Sure.
Just so they can at least
know what happened.
Blame it on something. Yeah. Right. But a number of these cases also turn out to be what we call asphyxial events, where it turns out that the baby just can't get air. The Centers for Disease Control actually sent some memos out a few years ago talking about a particular risk group, and that would be infants who are earlier in their ability to roll over from their back to side or stomach. So the early roller who is also swaddled.
Mm-hmm.
So we had this potential problem of a baby who rolled over sooner than parents anticipated, and it really would depend on where their mouth and head lay in any given crib or sleeping space. So,
but you're saying okay. So the recommendation to sleep on the back came to try to help prevent SIDS.
Absolutely.
But the combination of an early roller who doesn't have use of their arms because they're swaddled in, meaning they just get stuck with their head.
They may not be able
mattress.
To breathe. That's exactly it. It turned out to be important enough for them to send out some memos and some information to those of us who teach these courses. And I pass it along to parents. I don't have a position one way or another on swaddling. I tell parents that's something that they need to decide upon and talk to their pediatricians and do the research for themselves. So we're concerned about just creating as safe an environment as we possibly can. Mm-hmm. There's no question that backsleeping is still by far the greatest hedge against a SIDS event. But the offshoot that I referred to is now considered, I think they call it sudden unexplained infant death. And I think that would be something where a baby just has something in its mouth or somehow preventing their airway from functioning. Mm-hmm. So it could be something in the throat. It could be something outside the baby in the crib. For example, extra blanket or pillows or some stuffed animal. These are the kinds of things that...
So these are things on the accident prevention checklist.
We talk about this stuff, sure.
In how many years do you go through? Because you're saying 0 to 1 is where SIDS
right.
is a big concern. And
yeah. Well, then from statistics tell us that from year 1 through year 4, drowning is the leading cause of accidental death.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I've attended a couple of national meetings of the National Drowning Prevention Alliance. It's an amazing group driven in large part by families who've actually had this horrible thing happen, losing a baby or a child. And when I went to this conference, I went there as a clinician, someone who'd taken care of drowning victims before, but I'd never been in the presence of people who were as dedicated to helping other families not have this event repeated again.
Sure.
Must
be a lot of passion fueling them.
For sure. And yeah. The things that I learned I thought were extremely helpful. And this came, of course, from some discussion with a lot of experts on drowning from around the planet. One out of 5 drownings in the pediatric population actually occur in the presence of an adult who does not know that it's happening. And I think what this does is it flies in the face of many of the images we've seen over the years of a drowning victim who's splashing and maybe screaming for help. And most people that I've spoken to from the aspect of who's present and what did they hear or see is that there's no sound and things happen relatively quickly. And you can miss it if you're not paying attention. So our focus is stay close to that little one. Keep your eyes on them. Obviously you can wander a bit, but basically stay as close as you can and stay focused because you're not going to be hearing a lot if this actually occurs.
Are the drownings, are they in pools? Are they in bathtubs? Are they in toilets?
Well, first year of life, probably no surprise that infants are more likely to drown where we put them, and that would be in the bathtub. Even with an additional bathing device that many companies make, still, if a baby is not properly secured in it, if they're especially soapy and they're, how little ones are, they like to wiggle around a lot.
Slither around. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're just, all over the place. And if you take your eyes off or you're too busy maybe texting or trying to deal with other issues within the household, whether it's a mom or a dad or a grandparent or anyone else, you lose your focus. And it would be unfair and it would be absurd for me to say that those kids always drown. But we're talking about trying to lower risk mm-hmm. as much as possible. And that's what we're about. We're about helping parents try to figure out how they can lower risk to a great extent without going crazy. Because
yeah.
we have enough parents who are anxious for a lot of reasons. I wouldn't say unnecessarily, but especially first-time parents, they can be very anxiety-producing. And we want to make sure that they understand that stay close, stay focused, and things should be just fine.
Well, I remember sort of terrifying times where I'm alone with a baby in a bath and the doorbell rings or something happens like that. And you're just like, maybe I have like 30 seconds to just run, get it, and come back. And you're like, yeah. That's too long of a risk to, it's not worth it.
It is not worth it because the physiology of drowning is such that once we go under, the airway basically collapses and we stop breathing. If you're pulled out, and this is the thing I also mentioned to parents, even though this 1 to 4-year-old age group is at great risk, and this is, of course, the leading cause of accidental death, infants and small children who are pulled out of the water are revivable. And that's one of the most important things that we get, the message we get across. It's not just that they
revivable by us?
Revivable by us prior to the arrival of the paramedics.
Hmm.
Entirely possible. It just has to do with the nature of things and how by immediately starting CPR, we can reestablish circulation to the brain, and which is, of course, where all important things happen. But the purpose, of course, is to get oxygen back into the brain and reawaken those breathing centers and get them started to breathe again. This is how we distinguish, in fact, pediatric response to babies and children, as opposed to adults whose problem is typically more cardiac in nature, mm-hmm. where adults as babies and kids are generally more breathing or respiratory in nature.
Because of things happening at the brain?
No, it's usually something shuts off in the brain. In these cases, the cases of drowning or asphyxiation, the brain is just not oxygenated, and basically the baby or small child's heart rate starts to drop perilously low, and they lose consciousness. Now, if it's in the water, if it occurs in the water, it turns out that in many cases we've learned that many of these kids don't have that much water in their lungs but may have quite a bit in their stomach. Hmm. But in terms of the person who's actually there present with that small person, it won't matter to you and you wouldn't know where water is. That's right. You wouldn't know. You see a person who is essentially lifeless who needs CPR immediately. And one of the things we definitely want to get across to parents is that if you're alone with a baby or a child, if you are alone and you're faced with a situation where CPR is indicated, please start CPR first before you call 911.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, it's imperative that you do that because of the potential revivability. The two factors that will determine survivability in a drowning are one, which we may or may not have much control over, and that, of course, is length of time underwater. It is what it is. We find them, we pull them out. But we can't pull these little ones out and start calling 911. There's a long delay there, and by the time we establish that, things have gotten further along. And we can, with quick action and a little bit of luck on our side, we can actually turn this thing around.
Get them breathing again.
Get them breathing again. Yes.
But if not, then how long do you wait before calling 911?
Well, the Heart Association guideline for this is up to 2 minutes of CPR. And since we use a format for most pediatrics of 30 pumps on the chest followed by two rescue breaths, mm-hmm. If you were to do that five cycles, if you will, of CPR, 30 pumps and two breaths at the speed that we're suggesting, that's roughly 2 minutes. And the point is this, if they don't revive or respond, let's just put it that way, if they don't at least start breathing or moving spontaneously after about five cycles or roughly 2 minutes, then it's time to make the call.
Okay.
And we always encourage parents to make that call, put the phone on speaker mode immediately so you can have your hands free.
Yeah.
And keep your message to the dispatcher who's going to say something like, 911 dispatcher, what's your emergency? And I would say something like, my baby was pulled out of the water or my baby stopped breathing, whatever it was. I started CPR. Get over here now.
Mm-hmm.
And remind them also that a very small percentage of households now have a landline. Mm-hmm. But at least in Southern California, I'm not sure about other areas, landline calls are the old grid has the phone number and the address linked.
They know where you are.
They can spot you by that, but not on a cell phone.
Right.
Even with our sophisticated GPS systems, I'm surprised we don't have that working somehow. But consider that there are, over 40 million people in the state. Those lines are running constantly. So I have to give the state credit for being able to function as well as they do. But when we call 911, whether we're alone or not, I would put it on speaker immediately, so that the voice of the dispatcher, which is critical for people to hear, comes into the room because it becomes part of that resuscitation effort, a very big part. And it also, when we listen to 911 tapes and listen to what happens when the person starts to speak to the dispatcher, there's often a lot of additional screaming and yelling and people, and once the dispatcher's voice enters the room, there's an amazing calm that mm-hmm. takes over.
A lot of psychological first aid.
Absolutely. I've got somebody now in this room who's directing us where to go and how to do this.
Hmm. Well, I got to say, we do a lot of podcasts, and this is not the most exciting topic, but it's one of the most important topics.
I hope so.
So I'm learning a lot because it's been a while since I had my youngest. I used to work for the American Red Cross, the old competitor, and teach CPR and first aid classes. In fact, before we go to the break, I'll tell you this quick story. It was watching a CPR class when I was young, 7 or 8 years old, that got me interested in healthcare.
Really?
I sort of asked, what are they doing? And we had Annie there, and they were doing the compressions. And just seeing something about seeing how we can save a life, somebody else's life. We can have the power with a little education. It didn't take long. They just said, oh, yeah, they're going to be here for a day, and they can go save somebody's life. It set off something in my head from that point forward.
How interesting.
I wanted to take a CPR class, and then I took first aid classes. Then I did lifeguard, and then I taught for the American Red Cross. At 17, I became an emergency medical technician, and 18, started working in ambulances.
I didn't know that.
And that's how I ended up getting into healthcare as a living. So I think it's really fascinating and important for all of us, as many people as can possibly get educated on these topics, then you never know. I have, outside of my work in emergency medicine, my work in emergency medicine, have already used CPR at my brother-in-law's wedding.
Whoa.
My wife's...
Not the groom.
Not the groom. My wife's brother, when he got married, someone just went down at the smorgasbord, and people didn't even realize, you know, we're doing compressions, and I still hear people being like, hey, where are those pastrami breadsticks coming from? And the orchestra, the guy's looking at me like, what do I do? He felt like he was on the Titanic going down. He's like, do I keep playing? Do I stop?
Any appropriate song at this point?
Exactly, right? I mean, thank goodness a dentist actually walked up to us, and my father-in-law and I are working on this guy, and this dentist came through and had a defibrillator.
No.
And it's called an AED.
Yes.
So he ran and got the AED. They put it on the guy and a couple of shocks, and he came too. And the medics came right after that.
Sure.
Right.
That's
after
stunning.
That. So it's sort of amazing. That's just one example. There's been a couple of other examples, both in my own family, one of my kids who choked on something, and an adult where I was who choked on something. And the Heimlich maneuver it took a second, but made all the difference in life for her. So it's really important. And the fact that you've brought, 15,000 to 20,000 people, you've turned them into little lifesavers. It's kind of amazing, the work that you're doing. We're going to take a little break and come back because there's a lot more to learn here. And then for sure, one of the most important things is I'm going to want to know where we can find you online so we can learn a lot more. Come right back. We're going to be with Richard Pass on the Informed Pregnancy Podcast. This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike, Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby, not even diaper rash. Welcome back to the Informed Pregnancy Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Elliot Berlin, and we are continuing our discussion about child safety with our guest, Richard Pass. So before the break, we started to talk a little bit about CPR. One of the leading causes of death in toddlers is drowning, and that there's a really significant chance of saving that child with early CPR. That as soon as they come out of the water, that CPR is able to be begun. How do people learn CPR? Is it difficult to learn? And also, is it different for like children of different ages, how you do CPR versus adults? Tell me more about that.
Yes. Well, I think anyone can learn this. I know they can because I see people coming into our classes who have never taken a class or have had, it's been many years since they have. Many of them are a bit anxious. They've had experiences in some cases in other courses where they have been asked to sit through especially long videotapes and discussions and a lot of stuff written on the board. And not always that much time practicing the skills. Mm-hmm. And to add to that, I think many of the approaches we took where we had a whole series of actions that we would have the rescuer do, they were a little adamant in, you know, doing things in exactly this particular order and with specific techniques. And I think many people felt like if they didn't do it the way it was taught to them, that there would be a bad outcome.
That they would cause a bad outcome.
Or a bad outcome would occur. Something would occur.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not doing it right.
Not doing it right.
So I'm not going to do
it
at all.
Yeah, I mean, if you talk to people who hesitate, and, you know, in a public place in particular, and you ask someone why they wouldn't or didn't respond, it's usually, I don't know what to do. I'm afraid I'm going to make it worse. And I think in some people's minds, they take it a little further and somehow believe that they're responsible for the outcome. Mm-hmm. I would encourage people to read the California statutes called the Good Samaritan Act and realize that the law says that they consider the rescuer, that the rescue itself is an act of mercy. Mm-hmm. And one is not responsible for the outcome.
Yeah, you're pretty much liability free unless you do something grossly negligent.
That's correct.
Which is like, you know, nobody does.
That's correct. And, you know, you don't have to have some sort of CPR card or certification. You know, that's really only for people who need it for their particular work or mm-hmm. vocation. We talk to people about this all the time. We don't really need that in order to function. And the course that we teach is kind of an umbrella course. It's American Heart Association based, but we call it Family and Friends CPR. There are no videotapes. There's no exam to take. We explain to parents what the real risks are. And when we get through with that list of, you know, accident prevention and all those things, then we get down to the nitty-gritty and we demonstrate what this looks like. We remind people that there are really very few numbers they have to remember, that the act of CPR is an act of oxygen provision to the victim's brain.
Mm-hmm. CPR stands for cardiopulmonary resuscitation.
That's right.
So,
exactly.
I mean, what normally happens in the body is the heart is a big pump. The lungs exchange oxygen. So your blood kind of comes up into your lungs, gets a fresh dose of oxygen, dumps off waste product, carbon dioxide, goes back into your heart, and you get a big pump, and all that oxygen gets to every cell in your body.
That's correct.
If the pump or the lungs are not working, then either there's no oxygen to send around, and so you're just circulating blood that has no oxygen, or if the pump is also not working, then there's nothing circulating.
Correct.
But we can mimic that. We can make that happen. If it's not happening spontaneously, we can sort of make the pump pump, and we can bring oxygen into the lungs. And that's what the sort of essence of CPR.
Yes, and we had the experience of some researchers in Arizona about 15 years ago where there was anecdotal information that chest compression CPR without mouth-to-mouth mm-hmm. on adults seemed to have a beneficial effect. Once it was seen enough, it was then studied. And once these studies were completed, it took a while, but we now have a component. Both the American Heart Association and the Red Cross now offer at least an option to do chest compression-only CPR for adults.
Is it better, or is it for people who are not comfortable doing mouth-to-mouth?
Well, we believed initially that it would be a real opportunity for people who used their fear or talked about their fear of mouth-to-mouth resuscitation as a primary reason why they wouldn't do this. Of course, we had this whole sort of AIDS-related scare and this other stuff, which was erroneous. But at the same time, you know, when people do go down, especially when adults go down, it's not unusual for them to vomit.
Mm-hmm. No, so it's not. It's just hard to bring yourself to do it sometimes.
And they may smack their face on the way down, and they may be bleeding also. Yeah. So, I mean, that's not the first thing I would want to put my face on. And it turns out a lot of people did not, but continued doing chest compressions. And what we realized is that there's enough oxygen being circulated between the oxygen in the atmosphere, which is brought into the body with chest compressions, and the pull of oxygenated blood within the dying person's body itself that's brought up into the heart from the aorta, that a combination of those two for adults seems to be adequate to at least sustain that adult until the defibrillator arrives.
So it's not better, but it's enough.
It is enough in many, many cases.
Better than nothing for sure.
That's correct. And we now have paramedics that I've talked to many times over the years who, when they arrive at a cardiac arrest scene for adults, they will just start chest compressions and do several hundred until the defibrillator is juiced up and ready to go.
Mm-hmm. I remember we used to carry around just a little mask on the keychain. Is that still?
People still do that. I don't do it because if I ran into someone who needed CPR, I would do chest compression only CPR. Mm-hmm. The only person, the only adult that I would probably do mouth-to-mouth breathing on as well would probably be the adult drowning victim because the physiologically it may be much closer to what a baby or a child is experiencing. But one of the things – it's curious because one of the things that I mentioned to my my students is – not to focus on the differences between different sized children, be they 2, 3, 4, 6, or 10. Don't focus on the differences. There are many more similarities than there are differences. We talk about the fact that there are two life-saving spots on the front of the body. One is on the breastbone or sternum, right at the nipple line, or if you just come from underneath the victim's armpit straight across to where the breastbone is, that's where all CPR takes place. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to be fearful about whether you're pumping in the wrong spot. We want you on the bone, pretty much dead center in the chest. Middle, yeah. And that's true for all victims. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to worry about
regardless of age and size.
That's right. I send parents home. I say, when you get home and you're undressed tonight, take a look. That's where you're going to get pumped on if you needed it, and that's where you would pump on someone else. So get familiar with it. You don't have to waste much time looking for that spot. The other spot, of course, is for the Heimlich maneuver, which is intended for those who are over the age of one, at least the Heimlich maneuver that we know, which is the abdominal thrust. But the CPR format has many more similarities, and I focus on that.
That's really helpful because I think it gives you the confidence to act.
And we get feedback that people who left courses in the past and felt even more anxious for fear that they would do something wrong, they feel somewhat liberated and feel like they could actually make a difference. And therein lies, I think, you know, the possibility of increased lives saved.
That's spectacular. I know several of our patients take your classes and workshops, and then after a couple of years, they do it again because they want to get refreshed. Also, sometimes the protocols change a little bit, but it's just good to just get a redose so it's, you know, not so deeply buried in your mind. And if you needed to use it, you'd feel more confident leaping into action. Is there equipment or any kind of devices or tools that you recommend that people bring into their homes when they start to have kids in terms of first aid or the ability to provide life-saving skills to their children or family?
Well, I think the course that we offer provides them with, you know, a pretty good basis for being able to respond if they need to. But we don't recommend any particular device for CPR itself. We do, however, make a pretty big deal about the first aid requirements, and that it's entirely possible and likely that you're going to have to render first aid at any time to either a small person or, you know, yourself or possibly another adult. So we talk about the need for proper first aid equipment. Save a little life. We make our own first aid kits, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We have
just to be more definitive, when we talk about first aid, are we talking about like cuts and and bruises and breaks and stings and burns, that kind of stuff?
Yes, yes. A few of those items we do cover in class. For example, we talk about the importance of keeping hot liquids away from infants and small children just mm-hmm. because of the seriousness of the burn is dependent on, you know, body size and depth. So we talk about that. We talk about the fact that, you know, immediate submersion in cold running tap water is the only real treatment for a burn. Not to use anything else. Mm-hmm. To be cautious and careful around.
That's a really valuable thing to know.
And then there are some others, of course. The kinds of things we see, the choking itself, of course, is considered a sort of a first aid response. Mm-hmm. And I think parents are probably more concerned about the choking baby or child than they are anything else. And for good reason, choking is the third leading cause of accidental death in the pediatric population.
The first one is still drowning? Is that
well,
what you're
talking about? Drowning is from 1 to 4.
Okay.
Drowning is the leading. Actually, after 4, from 4 and up, automobile trauma or car accidents still sort of takes over.
That's number one.
It's number one, for a number of years.
Number two?
But these others, choking in particular, is mm-hmm. is always looming right at number 3, depending on, sort of age and so forth. What we talk to parents about is very important. First of all, to acknowledge that, human beings have 3 really good reflexes to help keep things away from our airway: gagging, mm-hmm. coughing, and vomiting. Mm. And any 1, 2, 3 or a combination of those will kick in very quickly. And we try to encourage parents not to overreact to gagging in particular. Mm-hmm. Infants gag with some regularity. Some gag more often than others. But to just change the baby's position a little bit more upright and not really get too excited about gagging. In fact, if you overreact to gagging, the children sometimes don't quite understand that. And I've had some parents who actually told me that their kids have actually used sort of little fake gags or gagging-like activities to get their attention.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
that's
so
crazy.
We have to kind of watch our own response to these things.
Yeah.
But look, we need to know if somebody really is in trouble. We need to be able to look in their mouth before we put our fingers in. That's one thing we always want to emphasize. Don't lead with your fingers. Take a look. Pry the mouth open if you have to. Somehow get a look in there and see what's going on. If you can get in, coming in from the side on the cheek, not in the middle, for fear, of course, that you might push something further back, come in on the side, scoop from one side to the other, and do the best you can. And if that doesn't work, we can certainly, for those who are under a year, we get them in a gravity-friendly, head-down position and strike directly between the shoulder blades, straight down, up to 5 times. If that doesn't work, we just basically turn them into a what we call a supine, or now they're facing upwards, and we push on the very same spot, the CPR spot, up to 5 times. Both those efforts are attempts to get these materials out.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, parents are successful doing that.
Yeah, so that's – I mentioned earlier about a kid choking on a carrot that it was just the striking on the back, holding him with his head down and striking on
that's
the
right.
back. And it just – it was very quick how it worked.
That's right. I should mention also that we've had some and of course I hear about some of these myself, but material that is not so much solid, a food or even maybe a rounded piece of candy or something like this. There are other things. For example, we've lost kids who have – little ones who have tried to swallow things like leaves or in some cases things that are a piece of saran wrap-like stuff, or the stuff that covers dry cleaning. Little ones will put that in their mouth. They'll try to pull it back. Of course, they'll try to swallow it.
So on the action prevention checklist?
Well, it's on the choking prevention checklist.
Oh,
yeah,
I see.
Yeah, for sure. We talk about that. We cover choking in its entirety. It's something that not only the public demands, but we understand how important it is. And we remind them that,
if someone's coughing, do you do anything?
Coughing is the best thing that could be happening.
So you just wait and
that's right.
Coughing, encourage.
That's right. We encourage coughing. And so if they are coughing, I would not even do anything except watch the effectiveness of the cough. In theory, the Heimlich maneuver itself is an artificial cough because mm-hmm. when we pull the diaphragm inward and then jerk upward on it. We're pushing that muscle, which sits beneath the lungs, into the base or the bottom of the lungs, which forces air pockets trapped at the very moment of choking from larger to smaller air spaces. And as it reaches upward towards the throat, it picks up energy. And that's the energy that can create that artificial cough.
Mm, very interesting. We just literally had this happen on Saturday. I was taking a little nap, and my daughter ran in, and she said, "Our next-door neighbor's baby is choking." Just happened on Saturday. My wife, who was already awake, got there first, and she said when she got in there, they were panicking because he was coughing, but not well, but also there's a little bit of blood. And so the blood made his parents very, very nervous. And I don't know, actually, because I wasn't there. I don't know what she did or if she just maybe just encouraged him to keep coughing. But the piece came out. It was a little piece of a snack.
Sure.
And it was fine. He was happy to just go about playing and as if nothing had happened.
And, you know, what and we tell parents—
parents are still traumatized, I think.
Sure. We just tell parents that, you know, if it's on the floor or within reach— it's going in their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
You can be assured of that. And that's the case for at least the first couple of years. Beyond that, you know, we still want to keep an eye on them. I want to mention one more thing because, you know, the laws in California for car seats require that little ones are facing rear for the first 2 years. And, of course, most of you guys know that infants are eating solids before their first birthday. So part of the one of the important risk reducers for little ones is to avoid feeding them in the car,
mm-hmm.
And particularly during those years when they're facing away. Because like drowning in many respects, choking is a completely silent event. And by the time you recognize it, if you do, it may be way past the point where you can be effective with a simple Heimlich maneuver. And remember, if a choking victim loses consciousness and goes completely out, it's CPR time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's important to know. Once someone is lifeless, regardless of
even
the cause.
They choked, it's
yes.
not Heimlich time,
that's
it's CPR
right.
time. It's at age one when you shift from the back sort of blows into the umbilical?
Sure, I'm glad you asked that because, you know, nothing magical happens on birthday one, but prior
well,
to the first year.
Cupcake, yeah, but.
really. Well, you know, they, the abdominal wall is not really – the muscles of it are not really there to support that infant, that early stage. They're developing. And so we do have an opportunity after age one. If we're very cautious, we can use a modified Heimlich maneuver. But I always tell parents that if you can turn somebody over, you can get them in a, you know, a head-down, gravity-friendly position, you can strike between the shoulder blades. It doesn't matter how old they are. And I've had many parents and grandparents and others save lives by just getting these kids over and doing that. But at some point, it's probably advisable to learn this other method. So the second life-saving spot on the front of the body is if you put your finger in your belly button and put your thumb on the bottom of your breastbone, there's a space between there. I feel it's about 4 or 5 inches maybe for me. And right in there, if you push on it, and cough while you're pushing in on it, you will feel your diaphragm.
Mm-hmm.
So what you need to do also is to be ready in a moment's notice, just like it was someone who needed CPR, to get to that spot. And that spot is just as easy to find on most people as it is the CPR spot. So I would be familiar with those two spots. Those are the two life-saving spots that we can intervene on and make a big difference quickly.
That's really helpful and valuable information. Before we sign off, two things. Number one, I know you have a kit.
Yes.
Of first aid items. What are maybe like the top two or three things that we want to have around in such a kit?
Well, we like to have in our first aid kits, we actually have three different sizes, a big family kit and a medium. First of all, I also think it's important to have something in your vehicle because we're, you know, active people and we're outdoors often, whether we're hiking or going to the beach here in SoCal, but you know, we may need to respond by having something in the vehicle. That's important. And the things that we stress, of course, are the ability to stop the flow of bleeding. So we have, you know, gauze bandages.
Mm-hmm.
We have antiseptics of various forms. We usually put a little vials of iodine and some other, or we just encourage people to use even soapy water to clean out certain wounds.
Clean a wound, prevent infection.
That's right. And, you know, we have I like saline solution, sterile saline solution, because it's very friendly to the body. And it's also very helpful to get things out of little ones' eyes.
Right.
Yeah, we do need in some cases to really restrain babies and small kids, because when something gets in their eye, they immediately go for it and they'll start rubbing. And, you know, if it's something like sand or some gritty material,
oh,
it can damage.
A lot of damage.
That's right. So there are times when, as parents, we have to actually restrain little ones in order to—
And flush.
That's right. And even if it means holding them under the sink while, you flush those eyes out, whatever you can do, you know, do it quickly. We also have, we have things like ACE bandages. We have first aid tape. We have a good quality scissors and a splinter forceps.
Are they available online? For,
they are available.
You can order it from anywhere.
You can. Yeah, you can. Ours are particularly good.
I'm going to do that because I certainly don't have one in my car, and that's a great idea.
Absolutely. I think it's important.
It reminds me when I went hiking with my son and he fell and scraped his knee pretty bad, and I carried him down.
That's
so
right.
I got an extra good workout that day. And then I got to the car and I didn't have anything. I drive to the closest pharmacy.
That's right. Yeah, we think it's important to do that. And first aid skills are, they're pretty simple. All of our kits come with a first aid manual with some simple instructions.
Great.
And a list of what's inside, so you know what it's for. But we go over those kits with the people who buy them from us. You can get them at our classes or you can get them online at Save a Little Life.
Okay, so tell me that one more time. Online, your website is SaveALittleLife.com?
SaveALittleLife.com.
All right.
That's
I will
right.
be visiting shortly myself.
I hope so. We've got a new expensive website.
Oh, great. Well, I'll make good use of it.
All right.
Richard, thanks so much for being here. Very, very valuable, informative material that you have. I encourage everyone to check out SaveALittleLife.com and to just learn a little bit more, because like Richard said, you could be, whether it's your family or not, you can be a lifesaver for somebody with just very limited amounts of training and information, and they can be a lifesaver for you. So do it and encourage others to do the same. Thanks a lot for listening to the Informed Pregnancy Podcast. We'd love to hear from you. If you have anything you want to share, write to info@informedpregnancy.com. And share us, too. Share us with your friends and family and followers. And then visit us online at informedpregnancy.com.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a whole lot of questions for you. This kid's gonna test my will. I got a lot to learn and my baby.
This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike, Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby, not even diaper rash.